You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 146, The Mines of Potosí, Part 6. Potosí is, quote, the city which has given most to the world and has the least, according to a local woman Eduardo Galeano spoke to at some point in the 20th century. He says that he spoke to her on the patio of her 200-year-old house, and that she was wrapped in a mile-long alpaca wool shawl. He also describes it as the poorest city in the poorest country in Latin America. I think that Nicaragua has undertaken Bolivia as the poorest nation these days, although Haiti is poorer still if you count it as Latin America. The point still stands, though. Last episode, we looked at the fraud, which provoked a man-made decline in Potosí's fortunes, but one which was avoidable. Advances in mining technology helped Potosí recover from about 1740, and of course, the high the city experienced was so high that declines have to be seen in relative rather than absolute terms. But what happened to create the situation which that woman described? The situation which I described from my own visit this century. The answer is, of course, linked to factors outside of the immediate area, just as such factors helped create that rebirth. So first, let's quickly look at that rebirth. The Spanish Empire can be divided in two. It began with the unification of Spain under Ferdinand and Isabella, and Columbus reaching the Americas for the first time, before it quickly passed into the hands of the Habsburg dynasty. After the War of Spanish Succession, Spain and its colonies fell to a new dynasty, the Bourbons. Their control constitutes the second half of the imperial story. Spain had such a head start on the other powers, being, along with Portugal, the first to expand beyond Europe, and doing so in such a big way. As we saw a few episodes ago, however, their methods of administration began to fall behind the other growing European powers. This trend will define the end of the Spanish Empire, but the Bourbons had roots outside of the country in one of those rising powers, France, and so they did recognise the situation and take steps to combat it. The Bourbon reforms were a sweeping series of changes to how the empire was run, designed to make almost every aspect of it more efficient and profitable. This worked to a large extent, although in the grand sweep of history, it only delayed the same outcome a couple of centuries later. Perhaps most notable of the reforms, as far as Potosí went, was that the royal fifth was halved to become a royal tenth. This, of course, was basically a tax cut, and so more silver extracted by miners was available for them to privately sell. On top of this, that war, which resulted in Bourbon control of Spain, drew in Europe's major powers. And as earlier Spanish kings showed us, war requires money. That war, as well as others, helped fuel renewed demand for Potosí silver and to spur its growth. Another important action was, in fact, a lack of action. There appear to have been plans to end the meter system, but these never eventuated, partly because of preemptive shutdowns organised by the mine owners. And so, the supply of almost free labour continued. A savings bank was established, which provided Potosí miners with low-interest loans and high-interest savings accounts. This would have been helpful in itself, but it was even more useful for enriching those involved, because control of it was given to the miners themselves, and so corruption which mirrored what we'd seen in previous episodes, took hold. Exactly a century after Marin had launched his investigation, another took place into this bank, and the man who did it seems to have had a similar character. When I mentioned that the meter system was retained, it was reformed by this man so that the indigenous labourers were guaranteed a very small hourly wage for their work. The mine owners responded by doubling their quota of ore to be extracted each night, so they didn't actually end up losing out, and the labourers had to work even harder. Some historians believe that simply expanding the meter and increasing the amount each person in it was obliged to produce was more important than any reform in increasing the amount of silver leaving Potosí. In the 1700s, a new mint had opened in Mexico City, and it was much more functional, efficient, and uncorrupted than the Potosí one had ever been. It was decided that the Potosí mint would be moved to a grand new building, which incorporated the technology and methods of its counterpart in Mexico. This is the mint building which stands in the city today. After this upturn, the decline re-established itself at the end of the 1700s. At the beginning of the 1780s, there was an enormous rebellion of indigenous peoples in Peru. Its two leaders harked back to Inca rule as part of their imagery and reasoning for the rebellion, and some of the earliest trouble took place in the wider Potosí region. There were many reasons for this, but the meter system was certainly one of them. The unrest was eventually dealt with, but it did disrupt Potosí's silver industry. By now, Spain once again found itself lagging behind when it came to reforms, technology, and economic ideas. Its best and brightest in the field of mining were sent to what is today Germany to learn their trade, rather than being taught at one of the many mines within the borders of the empire. Often this was paid for by the crown itself, which is a sort of indirect acknowledgement of the situation. Those who returned recommended that German mining engineers be brought in to reform Latin American mines. A man named Baron Thaddeus von Nordenflicht reached Buenos Aires in 1788, tasked by the king with sorting out Potosí. His writings show that he was appalled by what he found there. He describes it with the air of cultural superiority of someone who believes that the place he is visiting is backwards and terrible, both in terms of the techniques he was there to improve, but also when it came to the lives of the people living there. In that first episode of this series, I talked about how visiting the mines was like going back in time, but I hope it was clear that I was doing so without judgment of the people and place. Nordenflicht seems to have had a similar sensation, except he very much did see himself and his culture as superior. He also didn't achieve much. He spent lots of crown money on re-engineering things, but achieved only a small and temporary increase in production before moving on. One of his German accomplices did stay at another mine in the region, and with this long-term effort, he made it much more efficient. One man could not fix everything, however. Apparently Nordenflicht was very unpopular in Potosí, and although the journalist writing about this may have been exaggerating, a newspaper speculated that concerns for his safety may have played a part in his decision to move on to other mines. The problem was that all of the high-grade silver ore had run out. There was still plenty of silver in the mountain, but getting to it was difficult, as it was locked within the rocks which made up the mountain's innards. This is a common problem. One of the ghost towns in the Australian desert I used to pass sometimes, the one which Herbert Hoover was sent to oversee, in fact, was abandoned overnight in the 1940s. One day the administrator gathered the town population up, and this population consisted completely of mine workers and their families, and announced that the gold had run out, and everyone was out of a job. They literally packed up and left that very day. Yet if you go there now, just below the grand house which Hoover lived in, is a deep, deep open pit mine, with trucks wending their way up and down its walls. When the town was abandoned, there was simply no way of getting at the gold still there, but subsequent advances in technology have made the mine viable again. Now it's possible to get to the metal. Unfortunately for the town, these advances, as well as improvements in transport technology, mean that only a handful of people are required to work there now, and they can all be flown in and out. What Potosí needed was a similar technological advance to revive it. They thought they'd found it with the Born method, named after its German creator. Excited Potosíans believed that this machine would save their city, and the mining guild put a huge amount of money into building one. It collapsed on the first go. They repaired it nonetheless, and built a few more. It wasn't as useful as hoped, however.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
The machines also faced resistance from people who made their living refining ore the old-fashioned way, and who wielded enough political influence in the city to help organise resistance. There is a school of thought which holds that this sort of thing is exactly what keeps Latin America back to this day. I've heard some Latin Americans voice this sort of argument, although of course not everyone subscribes to it by any means. While other places move ahead, they say, self-interested motivations stifle innovation and progress, and political connections or the threat of direct action prevent those with power from encouraging the adoption of these new ideas. And so things stayed the same. In the 1790s, mercury shortages began, and as this was essential for the refining process, mined ore periodically stacked up until new supplies arrived. Although that rebellion had been put down, it had inspired the meter labourers to become increasingly vocal, and while this wasn't a major problem, it did create unease and the potential for another cause of disruption to production. The first 5 years of the 1800s were marked by drought, which stopped the refining machines for a whole year, as they needed water to power them. The drought also caused famine, which saw low-paid workers move away. There wasn't enough work for them, and the work there was didn't pay enough to buy the now expensive bread. This was followed by an epidemic linked to the damp of the returning rain. While the meter system was unenlightened enough in terms of how it provided labour to the miners, the shortage of workers that these problems provoked led some of the most reactionary of the mine owners to suggest that indigenous workers should be chained up inside the mines to ensure continued production. So I think we can say with a good degree of confidence that Potosí's best days were gone by this point. Presumably, no matter what alternate history scenario you imagine, it was going to be downhill from here. If you look at a graph charting the city's silver production, though, and use it as an indication for its general health, you will notice that the steep drop doesn't start until around this point. This correlates neatly with developments which had nothing to do with mining technologies or amounts of ore inside the mountain. This is, of course, the age of independence. So of course, a long and drawn-out war is always going to be bad for business, especially one which sees the continent rebelling against Spain and means that the obvious export routes are cut off. That's the minimum impact which the Wars of Independence would have on Potosí. On top of this, though, Bolivia was in a sort of in-between zone, with centres of revolutionary activity to the north and south. This meant that 1, its independence was one of the last to be achieved, and 2, it wasn't clear who was going to fight for it. Much of the fighting was done by Argentine independence generals from the south, but Bolivar did eventually make it there from the north, which is why the nation is named after him, and why the regional capital I mentioned in the first episode of this series, Chuquisaca, is now named Sucre, after one of his generals. Perhaps if the mine had either been near Buenos Aires, or in today's Venezuela, they would have consolidated control of it quickly, and this might have benefited it. Instead, it was a valuable target, and control of the city passed backwards and forwards between rebels and loyalists several times. The first time this happened, the meter workers took advantage of the situation and fled. The system would never be reinstated, and Simón Bolívar officially abolished it in 1825. During one round of fighting, General Belgrano, the Argentine independence hero, tried to blow the mint up. I haven't been able to find all the details about exactly what was going on, but indigenous workers refused to leave the building, and managed to defuse the explosives just before they went off. Eventually, in one of the last moves of the independence wars, Bolívar reached the city and symbolically climbed the Cerro Rico. It was here, about 15 years after the first skirmishes, that he declared South America completely free from Spain. Despite its falling status, I think this demonstrates the importance of Potosí. By this point, however, the mining industry had almost been wiped out by the years of war. Only a few big refiners were still clinging on, less than 15 in total. The mint was put to work by the new regime, but for 2 years they had to use it to continue to print the Spanish coins, which it had already been producing. It took them that long to sort out creating new designs and moulds. Independence did not simply replace Spanish crown control with that of the new independent governments. One of the two important strains of ideology running through those independence movements was liberalism. Its proponents sought to emulate their contemporaries in places like Germany and Britain, and import the Enlightenment ideas which had seen those places move ahead of the Spanish world. In economic terms, this meant free trade, and opening up places like Potosí to foreign private investment. British companies, in particular, decided to buy up parts of the mountain. Investors today talk about finding underdeveloped or underperforming assets, things with high potential, but which aren't reaching it, and as a consequence, are cheap to buy, but can be sold for a much higher price once some work has been put in to turn the asset around. Potosí was seen a bit like this. One of the biggest companies was the British Potosí, La Paz and Peruvian Mining Association, which employed one of the most important scientists of the day, and someone who travelled extensively in Latin America and will one day get a podcast series, Alexander von Humboldt. He and the rest of the company arrived in South America aboard a ship they had named the Potosí, its owners full of optimism. Their company failed soon afterwards, actually because of a stock market crash in London, rather than anything to do with Potosí itself. But this was emblematic. None of these foreign companies made their fortunes from Potosí. There was a short uptick in the 1870s, when the government relaxed restrictions on the industry, while global demand for silver was going up. It was the local Creoles who benefited from this, and much of the silver actually came from surrounding mines, not the Cerro Rico itself. The 20th century was not a good one. Firstly, the silver really did run out, and the government made a national pivot to focus on tin. Tin is found in the Cerro Rico, so silver was forgotten, and that became the primary target. Secondly, at the beginning of the century, better roads and railways were built to facilitate exports. This should have been a good thing, but in fact, it meant that the last of the silver and the tin which was beginning to be mined could be taken away to be bought by foreign companies and refined elsewhere. This killed the refining industry, which we followed from those earliest forges on the slopes of the mountain, which used Inca technology to catch the wind and help the fires burn hot enough to melt the ore. This is another of Galeano's major points. According to his dependency theory lens, The reason for underdevelopment in Latin America is that its primary resources are sold cheaply, and then the refined, processed, and manufactured goods these resources are turned into are sold back to the region at much more expensive prices. Perhaps symbolizing the decline of Potosí is the fact that the mint, one of the grandest buildings in colonial South America in its day, was used as a military headquarters during the Chaco War. After that, it even served as a stable for villagers coming to town for market. The last coin was made inside in 1951. The city of Oruro and its surroundings is the heart of the Bolivian tin industry today. So Potosí's population fell as some of its miners moved there for work. Last century also saw the growth of labour politics, and strikes and marches would become a feature of Potosí city life from the 1920s. Mining unions are still among the most powerful political blocs in the country, and have traditionally been staunchly left-wing, and initially big supporters of Evo Morales. It's certainly a big change from those centuries of the meter system. For the first half of the century, they had a big, powerful enemy to fight. The rich Creole mining barons, like Simón Patiño, who fought back to protect their profits and social status. With the 1952 revolution, however, all the nation's mines, including Potosí, were brought into state ownership. Most miners were now government employees, and enjoyed pretty good compensation for the tough, dangerous work they did, although there were many who were not formally employed and who earned very little, scavenging in old mine shafts. There was a military coup in the 1970s, and this, along with wider trends, saw the state-run mining corporation broken up, albeit by a democratically elected government, which came to power after the dictatorship had weakened the corporation. Lots of miners lost their jobs, despite determined strike action. The global price of tin collapsed, and so the miners resorted to zinc. Potosí declined further. The remaining workers organized themselves into the cooperatives that were in existence when I visited. They still largely mine zinc, but are happy to find the odd tin deposit, or even the smallest traces of silver on rare occasions. In the earliest years of the 21st century, an economically neoliberal president made an attempt to sell the mines off to foreign corporations, but faced an intense and organized backlash from the miners. Politics went in the opposite direction with the election of Morales, and although their politics aligned, there was often tension between him and them. In the time since I visited, around 2009, international commodity prices have been relatively high. That historian, Chris Lane, whose work has been so useful for my research, says that since his first visit in 1995, the city has developed and improved. Without visiting again myself, it's hard to know how much more developed it is than what I saw. Climate change is causing problems, however, as the Altiplano gets even drier. Centuries of mercury and other chemicals used to process the ore have made much of the soil surrounding the city and the mountain extremely toxic, and there are worries that this could cause problems at some point. And so that's it. While a set of mines might not seem like the most obvious candidate for a long series, it's certainly not as dramatic sounding a subject as the conquistadors or the pre-Columbian empires. Hopefully it's clear why the subject deserves so much attention and why the stories it produced are as interesting as any other. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something to help the show out, one thing which is quick, easy and free is leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts from. It helps new people discover the show and learn about Latin America. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Sargent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube. by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.